Welcome back to the second half of the reconstituted episode 59 of Words and Movies. I hope you had a restful break.
I did. Now, before we talk about Parasite, we should mention that this movie made history.
Yes.
It was the first non-English language movie to win Best Picture at the Oscars. Also the first movie to win Best Picture and Best Non-English Language Film, or as it used to be, Best Foreign Language Film, the same year. It also was only the second movie to win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival and Best Picture at the Oscars for the same year it was released. What was the first? That is a trivia question for you all, and I will have the answer for you at the end of this half of the episode. But right now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for Parasite.
Yeah, meet the Kim family. We have the dad, Ki-tae Kim, the mom, Chung-suk Kim, brother, Ki-woo Kim, and sister, Ki-jung Kim. The family lives in a semi-basement apartment where they struggle finding a Wi-Fi signal to latch onto in order to get into access to the internet to watch TV. They get fumigated on when the truck comes through their neighborhood. They have to watch men urinating in the alley outside their home. They make ends meet by doing a lot of menial tasks, such as folding pizza boxes, and even then they get criticized by the pizza employees for messing up the boxes. Ki-woo's friend Min-hyuk pays the family a visit, giving them a gift. It's a rock that's supposed to bring wealth and prosperity to those who have it. He then tells Ki-woo that he's been tutoring the teenage daughter of a very wealthy family. He's leaving to study abroad, but is in love with the daughter and knows that any of the other university boys would steal her away. He wants Ki-woo to be her tutor, knowing he will watch over her so that Min-hyuk can propose to her once she graduates high school. Ki-woo knows he isn't qualified since he isn't in college, but Min promises to vouch for him, and so he agrees and has Ki-jung forge credentials for him to take to his interview. Ki-woo interviews with the very wealthy Park family, where he meets Mr. Park, his not especially bright wife Mrs. Park, and their children, teenage daughter Dahaya and young son Daesung. Ki-woo realizes he needs to flirt with Dahaya to get the job, and he does. Mrs. Park pays him a huge amount of money, more than she was paying Min, in fact, and mentions they need an art tutor for Daesung. Daesung had a traumatic incident where he saw a ghost in the house, and he had a seizure, and he's been needing help with his art. Ki-woo introduces them to Ki-jung, who forges documents for herself and goes by the name Jessica, and she too begins making the big bank. When the Park's limo driver takes her home one night, Ki-jung leaves her underwear in the car in order to get him fired because he's clearly some kind of perv who has sex in the car when he's not driving the Parks around. Ki-jung then suggests her quote-unquote uncle as the new driver, who is really her dad, Ki-taek. The last position is that of the housekeeper, Moon Kwang. She has worked for the home since before the Park family lived there. She worked for the previous owner, a brilliant but eccentric architect. So in order to get her fired, the Kims use her allergy to peaches to make it look as though she has tuberculosis. And we can't have tuberculosis around the young boy, now can we? So, of course, she leaves and Mrs. Kim is given the job. And now the Park family has hired the entire Kim family. The Kim family enjoys their massive increase of income, and when the Park family decides to leave to go to camping for Daesung's birthday weekend, they take the opportunity to stay in the Park's house for the weekend. They spend the evening eating and drinking and making a general mess of the place when the doorbell rings. It's Moon Kwang. She claims she was fired so quickly that she left without being able to get something, and she just wants to get it back. Mrs. Kim reluctantly lets her in, and Moon Kwang runs into the basement and begins screaming, opening a secret passage behind some shelves. Down this passage is her husband, Jun-se. He's been secretly living in the bunker ever since the previous owner moved out because he's been hiding from loan sharks. She gives him food and water while Mrs. Kim looks on in horror. Finally, she tells Moon Kwang, "You gotta go." And as Moon Kwang begs her to let them stay, the rest of the Kim family who had been eavesdropping suddenly fall off the stairs and into view. Now, Moon Kwang knows the rest of the family by sight, if not by their correct names. So she breaks out her phone and she starts photographing them, having figured out the con that the Kims have pulled. She threatens to send it to the Park family and uses that so that she and her husband can force the Kim family to do their bidding. A huge fight ensues, during which the Kim family manages to get the upper hand, but suddenly the phone rings. It's Mrs. Park. The campground has been inundated with rain, and so they've canceled their trip. Mrs. Park asks Mrs. Kim to make a dish called Ram Dom for them. If she starts now, it'll be ready as they arrive home. Oh, 8 to 10 minutes, hence. The Kims scramble, trying to clean up or cover up as much of the mess as they can while keeping the other two in the basement. They manage to do a good enough job that the rest of the family is able to hide while Mrs. Kim gives the Parks their dinner. Moon Kwang breaks out and runs upstairs, so Mrs. Kim shoves her back down the stairs where she hits her head and she's severely wounded. Moon Kwang and Jun Se are locked in the bunker. Mr. and Mrs. Park end up sleeping in the living room in order to keep an eye on Dae Song, who is camping out in the backyard, and that's forcing the Kims to stay under the huge coffee table the entire evening, even as the Parks complain about the presence of Mr. Kim's smell. And then later, they have sex. Eventually, in the middle of the night, the Parks fall asleep and the Kims are able to sneak out. They return home to find their apartment completely flooded with rain and sewage. Ki-woo takes the rock and the family sleeps in a shelter for the night. Mr. Kim offers up his opinion on the futility of making plans. Ki-woo takes responsibility for everything that's happened and promises to fix it somehow. Meanwhile, in the bunker, Moon Kwang is trying to untie Jun Se with her teeth, but she's got a huge headache and she thinks she has a concussion. Jun Se tries signaling for help by flashing the outdoor lights in Morse code. And while Dae Song is a Cub Scout and understands the code, there are mistakes in the message and Jun Se doesn't get to finish what he's saying. The next day, Mrs. Park decides to throw an impromptu party for Dae Song. The Kim family, in their roles as help, are invited to the party. Now, Mrs. Kim is already there, but the others are still at the shelter, so the first step for them is getting decent clothes out of the donation pile. We see this parallel to a scene where Mrs. Park is in this gigantic closet picking out her outfit for the party. Mr. Kim arrives at the house early, and he has to tote Mrs. Park all over town to get party supplies. Unfortunately, he still smells a little bit like the sewage he was wading through the night before. So, the Kims are all at the party, and they have to pretend that they don't know that there are two people locked in a bunker underneath the house. Ki-woo in particular worries that he doesn't belong among the people here. He takes the rock down into the bunker, where we discover that Moon Kwang has died. Suddenly, he's ambushed by Jun Se, who beats him in the head with the rock. Jun Se then goes up to the party, where he stabs Ki Jung in the chest. Everybody at the party freaks out, of course, and Dae Song has a seizure. Jun Se was the ghost he had seen in the house prior. Mr. Kim, who's trying to stop Ki Jung's bleeding for the car keys to take his son to the hospital, and he throws them to him. But they land under Jun Se, who is fighting with Mrs. Kim. She manages to kill him by stabbing him with a skewer of meat. Mr. Park gets the keys, but expressed disgust at the way Jun Se smells, and it triggers Mr. Kim, who snaps and stabs Mr. Park, killing him. Mrs. Park faints as Mr. Kim flees. Ki-woo wakes up in the hospital, where he had been in a coma for weeks. A police officer is reading his rights, and all he can do is laugh. He finds out that Ki-jung has died, and that he and Mrs. Kim have been sentenced to probation. There has been no sign of Mr. Kim, even though the police have been searching for him far and wide. He and his mother find themselves followed by police for a long time because they think they know where he is. Eventually, the police tails stop, and Ki-woo leaves the rock in a river. He then goes up the mountain to look at the park's former house when he sees the lights flickering. He recognizes it as Morse code, and he starts taking notes. Later on, Ki-woo translates the flickering and learns that Mr. Kim is controlling them from inside the bunker, where he is now living, sneaking upstairs for food from the new owners. Because of all the murders, the house had been empty for a while, but he managed to get by for a while, and he was even able to give Moon Kwang a decent burial before the house was sold. Ki-woo writes his father a letter back, resolving that someday he will become wealthy enough that he can buy the house and their family can be reunited. And as he narrates this letter, we see it coming to fruition. However, what we've just seen is a fantasy, as the last thing we see is Ki-woo still in the basement apartment composing the end of the letter.
So, Bong Joon-ho, who directed and co-wrote this movie with Han Jin-won, he's part of the South Korean new wave that sprung up in this millennium, century, whatever, along with Park Chan-wook and other South Korean filmmakers who made a splash not only in South Korea but also worldwide. Unlike Hirokazu Koreeda, whom I've always been a fan of, especially with Shoplifters and the movie he did right after that with the star of this movie, Sung Kang-ho, who, by the way, is a Bong Joon-ho regular, but Sung Kang-ho starred in Koreeda's Broker, which is a very good movie that you should all track down when you can. But I was not always the biggest fan of Bong Joon-ho. You know, I do agree that he, like Ken Loach, his heart and his politics are in the right place, but the movies he's made, talking about, as he said, the fact that we all live on the same planet, capitalism, have not always worked out for me. You know, in genre movies such as The Host, Okja, and then his one English language movie, Snowpiercer, which is an allegory like Parasite, but one which takes place exclusively on a train. So I found them, again, a little too schematic, and then also a little bit too uneven in tone. Although I will admit, for the most part, Okja did work for me better than the other movies. But Parasite is the one where it seemed like Bong had it all together from the beginning to the movie to the end of the movie. I remember getting this DVD out of the library and watching it on my laptop on my way home for visiting my brother. And it happened to be the day of the Oscar ceremony that I watched it. And as soon as I got home, I wrote on Facebook, okay, now I understand what all the fuss is about, because other people in a movie group I used to belong with had been raving about this movie for weeks, and I understood why after watching this. And it is truly a remarkable movie, I believe. How about you, Claude?
I really enjoyed this film. It comes off as like almost kind of a dark comedy more than anything else. And I don't know if it was necessarily meant to be as such, or if it was just like this series of weird coincidences coming together. But I liked it. And again, watching it a second time, I was able to pick up on some of the, you know, subtleties that I might not have seen the first time. Like, for instance, I noticed, excuse me, the first time around, that there are a lot of stairs in this film. Okay, fine. But I don't think I realized, like, in that scene where the family escapes from the house after the Parks come home unexpectedly, and they're on their way home, and it's raining and raining and raining and raining and raining, and they are just constantly going down and down and down and down and down. And it's one of those things that really helps to emphasize the difference between the two classes, that, you know, well, these people live in the basement and these people live on a mountain, and, you know, these people, you have to go downstairs just to get into their house, and likewise, these people, you have to go up that very steep, slopey driveway to get into, and things like that. And so it almost makes sense that when they finally do get home, the house is filled with, you know, water and sewage and God knows whatever else. And it's just one of those, like, horrifically comedic scenes, you know, when you've got the daughter who is, like, basically trying to get above the waterline, and the only place above the waterline at this point is the toilet, and the toilet is spewing sewage, and so she, like, slams the lid down and sits on it. So even as she is sitting on it, and she's trying to smoke a cigarette and, you know, use her phone or whatever else, you can still see it spewing out the sides of the underneath the seat. And so, you know, I think funky little details like that you do see that there are different they're literally on different levels in so many different ways. And the other thing that I didn't really pick up on the first time, and I don't know why, is that the apartment that the Kims live in is at the end of the street, okay? Which, it's not good feng shui, frankly. You know, this is something that's very big in Asia, like the, you know, the layout of everything. And if something dead ends like that, that's not good, you know? And again, it's one of those things, like if, you know, here in the West, we might not have necessarily picked up on that right away, but it's something that the Asian audience might have grabbed immediately.
Well, Bong had said in interviews that he was surprised at how well this movie did outside of South Korea, because he thought only South Koreans or Asian people would get details like that and other things that he put in. And the fact that people from around the world related to this movie just showed, you know, unfortunately, how much capitalism has taken over the world. Mm-hmm. But getting back to the point you made about the stairs and the fact that the Kim family has to go down while the Park family is going up, you know, that is perhaps a nod to what Bong said was one of his influences for the movie. And that is a movie that we discussed in an earlier episode, Kurosawa's High and Low, or better accurately translated title, Heaven and Hell, in the fact that it's showing the discrepancy between the rich family and the poor medical student or doctor who kidnaps who he thinks is the rich man's son, when in fact it's the chauffeur's son. And another influence, according to Bong, was also a Korean movie, another Korean movie from 1960 called Hanyo, or The Housemaid, directed by Kim Ki-young, although I frankly prefer the 2010 remake of that movie, also done in South Korea, also called The Housemaid. And then also in the propulsion of the narrative, you know, even though the movie does fall on the right side of having the characters dictate the story rather than the other way around, Bong said that he was influenced by Mad Max Fury Road and how the narrative just seemed to run and run propulsively. And then one other real-life story that was an influence on this and then also led, has been turned into several different movies and plays, is the story of Christine and Léa Pepin, who were two French sisters who were living maids and who were convicted of murdering their employer's wife and daughter in France in 1933. And that was turned into a play by Jean Genet called The Maids, which has been filmed a few times and has been also turned into a few separate movies, including one that Bong has apparently contributed an interview for on the upcoming Criterion Edition, a Claude Chabrol movie called La Ceremonie, starring Isabelle Huppert and Sandrine Bonnaire and Jacqueline Bisset, among others.
Now, that's kind of interesting, because there are two potential influences I thought you were going to mention, and you did not. And one of them, I know you're not going to appreciate this because I know you're not wild about, but William Friedkin, and I'm thinking specifically about The Exorcist, and I know you haven't seen this in 100 years, but if you watch that movie, every time Father Karras enters a scene, he's moving upward. Okay, he's coming upstairs, he's walking up a ramp or a slopey road or whatever else. He's always entering a scene moving up, okay? So that's thing one. Thing two is Alfred Hitchcock. Lots of stairs in his films. And not only that, there is one scene where there are some Alfred Hitchcock films on a shelf behind one of the characters in one scene. So I was like, this has got to be a Hitchcock fan. Maybe he's not a Friedkin fan, but he's got to be a Hitchcock fan.
Well, as a matter of fact, he is a Hitchcock fan.
Okay.
So, yes, he did admit that Hitchcock was an influence on this movie as well. And as far as Friedkin goes, since he recently passed before we re-recorded this, I'll just say that, no, I'm not a fan and leave it at that.
No, I understand. But just that simple stairs motif and that he did employ for Father Karras' character.
But anyway, originally when Bong got the idea to do this movie, he was going to do it as a play until he realized that it would work better as a movie. And he made it work better as a movie in a lot of physical ways. Or he made it work as a movie, I should say, in a lot of physical ways. One of the ways that he did that was that he and his cinematographer, Hong Kyung Pyo, and I'm sure I butchered that, made the decision to shoot this in widescreen because he wanted, you know, every time the Kim family was together and not doing their job separately for the Park family, he wanted to shoot them all together in the same space to emphasize their closeness. Whereas with the Park family, we rarely, if ever, see them in the same shot together.
In the car, I think that's be about it.
Yeah.
When they're coming back from
when
the camping.
They're coming home. You know, other than that, they really are not together. And that emphasizes the fact that they are not close. You know, although the mother, who's played by Cho Yo Jung, does care about her son, Da Sung, who's played by Jung Kyun Jun. She's clueless about how to help him. And ironically, even though Ki Jung, who's played by Park So-dam, or as she calls herself, Jessica, and I should add, the whole thing she does with her brother when going over the cover story that she's going to use. Jessica, only child, Illinois, Chicago, classmate, Kim Jung-mo, he's your cousin. That has become both a GIF and a meme on the internet, or it became one. And there's even a YouTube tutorial on how to do that whole signing gesture she's doing. But anyway, even though she makes up that whole thing about, what the son is really trying to show in his drawings, you know, it actually does help. And that's the one of the wicked jokes that Bong plays in this movie. You know, even though, except for Ki Woo, who's played by Choi Woo-sik, maybe is how his name is pronounced, you know, except for him, all the other members of the family got their jobs with the Park family under false or underhanded circumstances. They're actually good at their jobs. You know, the father was a driver, so he knows how to do that. The mother, Ki Woo, who's you know, obviously she's a mother, so she knows how to do housekeeping, but, you know, she's worked at it before. And, you know, they're all very good doing their jobs.
Yeah.
It's just that they got these jobs under false pretenses or underhanded circumstances. So that's one of the great jokes of the movie.
Yeah, it is. I was also thinking about, you know, coming back to the Hitchcock thing, is Moon Gwang, the original housekeeper, she was giving off real Mrs. Danvers vibes from Rebecca, you know, as far as like, you know, I am the keeper of this house and trying to, you know, maintain the memory of the great architect who first built this place and so forth.
Although not quite as coldly forbidding or giving off lesbian vibes like Judith Anderson did.
No, I'll give you that. But it was the same kind of thing. Like, she is there to protect some kind of legacy, you know, as the house passes from one family to the next, and maybe even presumably to the family after that, you know, should she have survived. You know,
and then you realize it's not just that
she's protecting, right.
Okay. Now, other technical ways that Bong tried to tell the story here is that both the apartment and the house are sets,
right,
that were built by Bong and his production designer, who was nominated for an Oscar but did not win. And that production designer was Lee Ha-jung, and the art direction was by Se-jin Lim and So-ra Mo. And, you know, the apartment is pretty simple, but the house exists on many levels, as does the movie. You've got the children's bedrooms, and then the living room and kitchen area, and then the basement. And it's all done in this very postmodern design,
In fact, there's like a basement, and then there's a sub basement, because the garage is part of the basement. So they had to actually go, and you only get a good sense of this once is when Mrs. Kim is headed down the stairs, and the camera follows her, and you realize just how far down this bunker is located.
And another thing that Bong did that has been done by other directors in this Around the World series that we've talked about is that he used a lot of digital effects in the movie. He digitally added the trees outside the park house, for example.
Really?
And all the driving scenes. Everything that you see outside the windows when someone in the car is green screen digital effects, because he did not want to distract the actors when they were doing their scenes in the car. So that is another example of how digital effects, when done right, can be very useful, and for things other than action scenes and CGI than the CGI battles. Now, another nice little touch two other nice little touches that are in the movie. One is the fact that Dasung dresses up as a Native American, and that might have been inspired by colonialism attitudes of the rich, of the Park family, but it also serves as a nice bit of foreshadowing. as to the fact that basically there's a bloody massacre that takes place at the climax of the movie. And then another nice little touch that I liked when I the second time I saw this is the name of the tech company that Mr. Park owns,
yeah,
because that's how he's made all of his money. It's called Another Brick, as in Another Brick in the Wall, the famous song from the Pink Floyd album, The Wall. Now, Bong, when someone pointed out to that to him, he said, well, yes, I am a fan of that album, and it wasn't an intentional reference, but it may have been an unconscious one.
Yeah, I kind of took that as basically we were at the last step there of the Kims kind of taking over the household, and basically that Mr. Kim was just the last brick. He was just one more brick in that pile of Kims coming in, and it works both ways.
Right. And should mention that all of the actors in this are good. You know, as I mentioned, Song Kang-ho, he's been in a lot of Bong's movies before. He was a detective in his serial killer docudrama, Memories of Murder. He's in The Host. And he's in Snowpiercer, but I think this is his best performance for Bong, playing the most well-rounded character of the characters that he's played before. And then also in the previous movies that he did for Bong, in Memories of Murder, his character is someone who's very gung-ho at his job, but not quite good at it, though he gets better. In The Host, he's someone who is doesn't seem to be right in the head. And I don't mean mentally challenged. I mean, he's sort of seems to be out of it at times, but he eventually gets better through the events of the movie. And in Snowpiercer, he plays someone very jaded and doesn't want to do much. Here, it's sort of the opposite. You know, he plays someone who always says, you know, I have a plan. This is how we're going to deal with. And then you get that speech right before the climax where he says, you know, listen, I'm just making this up as I go along.
Right. The best plan is no plan.
Yes. Everyone else. So he's sort of the opposite of the characters he played. And I think in the Bong's previous movies, and I think he does a better job with that in this movie. And then also, you know, I do think that of all the other actors, I was impressed with Park So-dam, the Park's daughter, or the Kim's daughter. You know, she, I think, is the perfect combination of cynical, know-it-all, yet at the same time you do sense that she does care for the family, and her reaction when she gets stabbed is very good. It's mm-hmm. not even horror. It's like, ah, crap.
Yeah, and not only that, I was looking a little bit more closely on the second view, and the thing is, like, Mr. Park gets stabbed directly in the heart, so he goes down hard, you know, whereas she does not. It's a little bit, like, up and to her left, and so it's still not a great place to get stabbed, to be sure, you know, but it gives her the ability to actually live long enough to have a few lines before she eventually dies. So basically you get the feeling that, that, you know, in her case, she just kind of bled out rather than, you know, died of, like, you know, her heart being damaged or her lungs or whatever else. Not that that's any better or worse, but it, it is different. But the other thing I liked was, yeah, she's got this funky level of competency going on, you know, in various things. So, you know, it was her idea to look up how to fold the pizza boxes so that they could do it efficiently and quickly and whatever. So, hey, if we could do it like this, great. You know, we'll make all kinds of bank. And she's also the person who does all the document forgery, you know, that she does with, again, great level of competence. Right. And if we could just channel that energy into something positive, well, wouldn't that be nice?
Yes. Now, a few things here also come from Bong's own life. He was a tutor to a rich family at one point in his life, and he also decided that that was the one way that could bring both of these families together, was have one of them being a tutor. And then also, when he was involved in, when he was at university, he was involved in a lot of protests against the South Korean government at the time. And he was attacked, along with the other protesters, of course, with tear gas many times. So that's why he's used, you know, gas of some kind in many of his movies, including the gas that's used to fumigate the Kim's apartment.
Well, accidentally fumigate the apartment. They're meant to fumigate the street.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Do you have anything else that you want to add before I answer the trivia question?
Well, you know, I do have that thing about funky titles, and I don't really have anything especially good here. But I will note something that I thought was kind of fun is that, you know, sometimes films have to be changed a little bit for foreign audiences. So, and in this case, foreign means not in Korea. And so toward the end of the movie, Mr. Kim is writing that letter to his son, and he says that basically the German family in the house, which I don't quite buy, but he says something about how the Germans just eat more than sausage and beer, and that's a big relief. But in the German version, he says that they're Americans and they don't just have burgers and Coke in the fridge, which I thought was kind of amusing. And then the other thing, which wasn't necessarily funny, but I just thought it was just kind of interesting because, again, you have to make that translation from one place to another, is the university that they use outside of Korea. It's Yonsei University is the Korean university that they use, but they figured like foreigners wouldn't necessarily understand that. So for foreign release, it turned into Oxford University as the school that the son was had been attending.
Okay. I did not know that. Although about the German family, you know, I figure that's a case of, well, who in South Korea is going to want to buy a house where all of this happened, and maybe a family from outside the country wouldn't have heard about it?
Well, he mentioned that it was a family that had just moved to Korea, but the thing is, there's stuff in the house that doesn't suggest that they're German, but maybe Swiss?
Okay. Well, that I didn't really I didn't really think about too much.
Fair enough.
Although, speaking of things of how they, not how they translate, but speaking of funky titles, of course, the title of this movie, Parasite, it's arguable, you know, who's really the parasite here, the Kim family or the Park family, or both of them actually are parasites feeding off of each other, because, you know, you get that whole scene where the Kim family is in the house before Moon Gwang knocks on the door, and they're talking about, you know, what they would do if they were rich, and does rich actually make you nice or nicer than you would be if you were poor?
Money irons out the wrinkles in your life.
Yes, you know, so that's a nice scene. And because the whole movie is played at these heightened circumstances, it doesn't come off as a tract, which is good.
Yeah, but let me offer this up, is that there, and you mentioned this in the first half, there are no heroes in this one. There are no good guys. No. There are no bad guys. Everyone is a parasite. And I'm talking everyone, because you've got even like the person from the pizza place, she's kind of preying on the Kim family. And I'm not going to pay you what I said I would pay you, right? The Kim family, that one's pretty obvious. The Park family, that's kind of obvious. Moon Gwang and Jun Sei, parasites. Yeah. Even Jun Sei is like living off the Parks, and they don't even know it.
Respect,
right? And then at the end, Mr. Kim, still living off the, you know, German, Swiss, whatever family, you know, waiting for, you know, some opportunity to, you know, live his life in some other way. And I'll even back that up is what was his name? Lin, right? The guy at the beginning who offers up the rock. Okay. The only reason that he wanted the son to do the English lessons is to keep the daughter from falling in love with somebody else while he was away. So even he is not a good person. Everybody is feeding off of everybody else in this film.
Yeah, that's the planet we all live on, planet capitalism.
There you go.
So, and now comes where I reveal the answer to the trivia question.
Yes.
What was the first movie to win both the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival and Best Picture at the Oscars for the year it was released? Marty, which was written by Paddy Chayefsky, based on his teleplay. Now, some people would say Lost Weekend also belongs there, but it won the Palme d'Or after it won Best Picture, and also it shared the Palme d'Or with a bunch of other movies, so I don't really count that one.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, that is it for this episode. Now, since we already released episode 60, we'll tell you again what's coming up in episode 61. We're going to look at two movies that concern characters confronting their past. And those movies are, from 1996, Lone Star, written and directed by John Sayles. And from 2003, Mystic River, directed by Clint Eastwood. Before I tell you how you can watch those, I should jump back a little and say that both Shoplifters and Parasite are available on DVD. Parasite is available on a Criterion Edition DVD. A 3-disc version, also Blu-ray, which I think only has 2 discs. And that Criterion includes a black and white version of the movie, if you can believe that. But if you prefer to stream...
Oh, can I mention, I did read about this, is they didn't just desaturate the color from that film. They actually worked on making it look good in black and white. So it wasn't like they just stripped the color values out.
Yes. No, it does look like he actually shot it in black and white, even though that's sort of impossible to do nowadays, unfortunately. But if you'd rather stream both movies, both Shoplifters and Parasite, you can watch if you subscribe to Max, or if you subscribe to Max through Amazon, or if you subscribe to DirecTV, or you could rent or buy them through Amazon, Apple TV, Alamo, Drafthouse online, or most other streaming services. And as for the movies we're talking about in episode 61, both Lone Star and Mystic River are available on DVD. And you can rent or buy Lone Star through Amazon, Apple TV, DirecTV, and other streaming services. As for Mystic River, the same thing. You can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, and most other streaming services. And you can find us on our website, which is wordsandmovies.com. If you have a comment or a question, you can email us. Our email address is wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. And we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/wordsandmovies, where you can also leave a question or a comment on our various posts. And Claude, I understand we now have an Instagram page.
By golly, we do. It's Words and Movies Pod at, you know.
Okay. And you can find me, Sean Gallagher, on Facebook as well, under my name, Sean Gallagher.
You can find me on that Book of Face under my own name, Claude Cole, and you can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com.
Okay, so thanks for listening to our rebooted episode, and we will see you next time.
Thank you for giving us some piece of your attention for this last little bit. Alex, take us away, please.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.